Again, now we're looking at this right off the bat. We're slowing down and we're looking at the, you know, this first line of the Apostles' Creed. I believe in God, the Father Almighty, creator of heaven and earth. And we're taking now, it's going to be up to 3 weeks on this point of creation. And I felt like I really needed to do this because when we look at this, there's probably no truth of our teaching, of our Christian belief, that's more under attack than the idea that God created the heaven and the earth, that the world is the result of creation. And not only that, but it's probably one of the foundational truths to everything that the Bible believes or teaches and that as Christians we believe. And now it's under attack because there are people that will be out there and that will say that, well, science teaches one thing. Science teaches that we're the product of evolution and well, Christians believe in creation because the Bible teaches that in spite of the evidence of science. And there's a lot of Christians who even believe that. And we spent a lot of time on this last week, and I want to just touch on it. The idea that's a lie. No, that the Bible isn't in disagreement with the teaching of science. And so we've got to look at what is the balance and the relationship between evidence and reason and biblical faith. The idea that that we take these things. See, people will argue that there are different kinds of truth. Well, here's scientific truth and what we study in nature, and then you have religious truth. And so when people talk about creation, well, you're making a religious claim, and that's different from the facts of science. And what we saw last week is that, no, there's one kind of truth. Truth is truth. Something is true because it describes what's real, what's actual. And something can't be real and true in one area of life and false in another area of life. If it's something that's true scientifically, it's true spiritually, it's true historically, something is true because it describes what is. So when the Bible says, in the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth, God's making a statement about truth. If God created the heavens and the earth, that's not in a way a religious statement that there is a God and he's the source of everything. It's a scientific statement and it's a historical statement because it's what happened. And likewise, we should then expect that when we study science, that should affirm that truth. And what we see is this idea that when the Bible talks about faith, it does call us to faith, but it's a faith that is rooted in truth, that's affirmed. See, again, people will often talk about the idea that faith is a leap into the dark. We're supposed to say, well, the Bible says this, and so I close my eyes and I leap there, and I either don't consider reason, or even if reason and logic say that it's otherwise, that we have to turn off our brains to believe. And that's often presented to be the case. But Christian faith is rooted in the truth. And actually, the Bible goes to great pains to root the Christian faith historically in truth and scientifically in truth. It doesn't call us to a blind faith, but to intelligent faith. Look at the passage we're going to look at this morning, 1 Peter chapter 3. But in your hearts, honor Christ as Lord as holy, always being prepared to make a defense to anyone who asks you for a reason for the hope that is in you, and yet do it with gentleness and respect. And so what does it say? It doesn't call us to a leap into the dark that goes against reason, but it calls us to a faith that is reasonable, that has reason behind it. It's a step toward the light. It's consistent with logic and reason. And again, we could go in the Bible and we can see historically the Old New Testament roots it in history because it wants us to see it's rooted in truth. And when we look at this whole issue of creation, the Bible itself calls us to look at nature and to see the facts of nature, of science. We looked at last week, Psalm 19. The heavens declare the glory of God, and the sky above proclaims his handiwork. Day to day pours out speech. Night to night reveals knowledge. So we should look to creation, to science, because we should expect to see God there. We should expect to see how God has revealed himself. Now, when we talk about faith, there is a sense that faith goes beyond what we can know. There is a sense that we have to make a step of faith. Because while faith should be something that is consistent with logic and reason, at the same point, it's something that goes beyond logic and reason. And so the fact is, we should look at it, and the fact science will show us it's consistent with God's creation, but the fact is I can't scientifically go back or historically recreate creation to totally prove it. There's a step that goes beyond what we can know, but it should be consistent. And when we look at the passages that we're seeing, especially this one in 1 Peter, what we're seeing is that the Bible calls us to not only realize this, but to know something of the rationale of our faith, to understand it. See, again, a lot of Christians, unfortunately, never learn to defend their faith. Many believe that, you know, that, well, I believe in creation in spite of the evidence, and so we kind of run away from that. But again, look at what it says in 1 Peter. Look at what it calls us as followers in Jesus Christ to do. It doesn't call us to a blind faith that is in spite of the evidence, but what does it say? In your hearts, honor Christ as Lord as holy. Now, one of the ways that we honor him is how? Always being prepared to make a defense to anyone who asks you for the reason for the hope that is in you. And so one of the ways that we honor Christ is being prepared to make a defense, to understand the truthfulness of our faith and being ready to be able to explain it to other people who are struggling with it. To be ready to explain the reason, to explain the logic, the truthfulness behind the hope that is in us. Now, we're not looking to argue with people. We're doing it with gentleness and respect. But yet, at the same time, we're not backing away. Why? Because, again, what we're seeing is the Bible says repeatedly that creation reveals God. That God has revealed himself not only in his word, but also through his creation. One other passage where you see that, Job chapter 12, and there's a lot of these. Look at what Job 12 says. But ask the beasts, and they will teach you, the birds of the heaven, and they will tell you, or the bushes of the earth, and they will teach you, and the fish of the sea, they will declare to you. Who among all these does not know that the hand of the Lord has done this? In his hand is life and every living thing and the breath of all mankind. So again, what we're seeing is this idea that God calls us to look at his creation, his nature, and how he's revealed himself. And so this morning, we're going to be spending now a lot of time looking at science. And through science, we're going to see again God's self-revelation. But we're seeing that this is, in a sense, it's a contrast of two different stories. And we have two different stories, two stories that make claims about ultimate truth. And what we have to look at is in the defense of our faith, how do we interact with these two stories? Which one seems to be more consistent? And the first story tells us, in the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. And the earth was without form and void, and darkness was over all the face of the deep, and the Spirit of the Lord was hovering over the face of the water. And God said, let there be light, and there was light. And you see then, step by step, God bringing order and speaking the world into creation. Now, that's one story. The other story reads, in the beginning, there was nothing. And from that nothing, a singularity formed, a small spot in that nothingness. And suddenly, from that nothingness, that singularity exploded with great force, and that explosion created all the matter in the universe. And it was an explosion that not only brought the matter into existence, but it organized itself into stars and galaxies and planets and then ultimately into life. Now, that's another story. Now, here we have two stories. Which one is true? Both of them are making statements about ultimate truth. They're making statements about where we come from, where we're going. They're religious statements, but also about history, also about science. One is true and one is false. One is ultimate fabrication. Which one? And so how do we do it? How do we know? Well, what if we just follow science? Even in science, there's a law of causation. The basic law that everything that had a beginning had a cause. That's a law that we know in everything in science. So now if we apply that law of science to this, what do we know? Well, let's follow through. The universe had a beginning. Therefore, it has a cause. So this idea that even if we just in the very beginning and we just follow logic, if we just follow laws of nature, right away it says, okay, no, there isn't anything that exists without a cause. But let's even go deeper than that. You see, I want to look at not just the implausibility that we say that everything that exists came from nothing, but I want to go deeper and say, okay, let's look at some deeper aspects of these. And you realize that these two stories are, again, creation, and we're going to say not only creation, but behind it is materialism. We looked at that last week. This philosophical idea, or I'm sorry, materialism and evolution are the same idea, and then creation is this other. They're both claims that require faith. You see, there are some, again, that will argue, well, creation is religion, and that's faith, and evolution is science. But again, that's not true. We looked at, if you weren't here last week, go back to this, because we explored this deeply last week. It's really, ultimately, evolution is based on a philosophical assumption of materialism. And it's an assumption that says that the only thing that can be real is that which is in the material world, things that we can see and test and manipulate. And so it excludes the possibility of the supernatural, not because there's evidence that there's no supernatural, but because we're not even can consider it as a possibility. It's not a scientific fact. It's a philosophical assumption. It's a worldview. And ultimately, it's a religion because it makes huge assumptions about everything, about the spiritual reality, about where we come from, where we're going. And likewise, then we see out of that comes the theory of evolution. It's a worldview. It's not science. It starts with the assumption of materialism, and then it can't be proven. Those assumptions can't be. And so we've got to realize that both of these are making truth claims. Both of them seem to appear to science. Both of them ultimately require us to go beyond what we can know to a leap of faith. But the big question we have to ask then is, which one is more consistent? Because if faith is something that is consistent with logic, it goes beyond logic, well then, which one of these stories is more consistent with the logic? Because if one is telling me, you know, again, all the science evidence tells me that this is false, I shouldn't blindly close my eyes and go into that step, even though all the evidence is against it. On the other hand, if one is totally consistent, even though it goes beyond what I can explain and understand, you see, that's the step of faith that obviously makes more sense to take. And so again, so we're going to ask this question, which one is more consistent with the claim, with the evidence of science? So let's look at this. We're going to spend this time now evaluating the truth claims with the evidence of science. We started this last week. We looked at a few things briefly, you know, the origin of the universe and the organization of the universe and the origin of biological life. And I recognize that in this, now we're going to not spend as much time in the scripture. What we've done is we've seen in the Bible calling us to look at science. And so now what I'm going to do is that I'm going to go back into God's creation, and I'm going to see more how God has revealed himself, asking this question, does the evidence of nature affirm the story of the Bible, of creation, or is it more consistent with the story of evolution? So to do this, I'm going to step away and not just be Pastor Mike, but take up the role of, again, Pastor Mike, the science guy.
Jet lag with Pastor Mike.
Jet lag.
Jet lag with Pastor Mike.
You got to go back and see the old Bill Nye the Science Guy introduction, and you would appreciate it all the more. And Danny did a great job. Now to do this, so we're going to be looking at what is the evidence. And I'll tell you where I'm going to start is probably somewhere that you wouldn't expect. What I want to do is I want to start by looking at Darwin's own standards for evaluation. You see, when you do scientific research, basically a scientist will come up with a hypothesis, and then you test it. You go and you try to get information, and if the information is consistent with that hypothesis, then you affirm it. You say, okay, well, this is truth. If it is inconsistent, then generally a good scientist will abandon the hypothesis because the evidence has proven them wrong. Now, Darwin himself gave us a couple standards. When he was going through this, he was saying, these are the things that we should research and find, and if these things are true, then it proves my point. If they're false, then it disproves my point. So his basic theory started with this idea that life starts simple, that you have to have simple things that can happen by accident, and then the laws of nature, of the survival of the fittest, actually push the development toward the complex. But here's what he said as far as this own, in his chapter 6 of his book of The Origin of Species. He said, here's how we evaluate his own theory. Look what he said. He said, if it could be demonstrated that any complex organ existed which could not possibly have been formed by numerous successive slight modifications, my theory would absolutely break down. So in other words, he's saying basically, it has to start simple and then get complex. And if you show that there's anything that starts complex and it couldn't have started with the simple, then my theory's wrong. All right, so okay, let's use that. Let's use his own thing. And we could actually go to a whole lot of things and look at this, but I'm going to go to the most simple thing, and that's say, let's look at the simple cell. Okay, if life started with a simple, that's the simplest thing, a simple cell organism, and therefore he's saying, okay, if that's where it started, it has to be really, really simple. Now, in Darwin's day, the cell was viewed as very simple. It was seen as this globule of protoplasm consisting of carbon dioxide, oxygen, and nitrogen. And until about 1950, biologists assumed that it was just this simple thing that these pieces could come together and naturally create a life, biological life. So life started in this very, very simple cell, and then it evolved into more complex beings from the simple to the complex. Now, that was the theory until the 1950s. Then they invented something called the electronic microscope, which has allowed scientists to go far deeper into the cell, and it continues to grow. I mean, you could see things that they couldn't have dreamed of seeing back then. And what they found is amazing. And we're going to come to DNA in a moment, and that's the most complicated thing of it all. But what they've discovered even beyond that is that every cell is literally this microscopic world. It has machines, complex machines, literally molecular machines. You know, they're molecular trucks that carry supplies from one end to the other, machines that capture energy and from sunlight and turn it into usable energy. And it just is incredibly complicated. Now, I can try to explain it, and I wouldn't do that well because I don't understand it that well. But so let me show you a little video that I think explains the science far more aptly than I could. It tells you a little bit about the complexity of just as this the simplest form of life, the simplest cell, one cell organism.
With computer animation, we can enter the cell to view this remarkable system at work. After entering the heart of the cell, we see the tightly wound strands of DNA, storehouses for the instructions necessary to build every protein in an organism. In a process known as transcription, a molecular machine first unwinds a section of the DNA helix to expose the genetic instructions needed to assemble a specific protein molecule. Another machine then copies these instructions to form a molecule known as messenger RNA. When transcription is complete, the slender RNA strand carries the genetic information through the nuclear pore complex, the gatekeeper for traffic in and out of the cell nucleus. The messenger RNA strand is directed to a two-part molecular factory called a ribosome. After attaching itself securely, the process of translation begins. Inside the ribosome, a molecular assembly line builds a specifically sequenced chain of amino acids. These amino acids are transported from other parts of the cell and then linked into chains often hundreds of units long. Their sequential arrangement determines the type of protein manufactured. When the chain is finished, it is moved from the ribosome to a barrel-shaped machine that helps fold it into the precise shape critical to its function. After the chain is folded into a protein, it is then released and shepherded by another molecular machine to the exact location where it is needed.
Now, you might be asking, why in the world would I show that video? I mean, I would acknowledge for the vast majority of us, myself included, that's way over my head scientifically. I don't share this because I expect that you fully understand it or that you would remember any of the scientific facts that were presented. My purpose in showing this is that I want you to see the incredible complexity of the simplest single-cell organism. And I want you to ask, do you think there's any chance that this single-cell organism created itself, spontaneously came together? Now, you may not understand the science in the film clip, and I don't think that's even necessary. We're not going to remember it. But what I want you to do is that I want you to think of that and then go back to Darwin's own standard. And he said, this is the standard by which you evaluate my theory. He said, if it could be demonstrated that any complex organ existed which could not possibly have been formed by numerous successive slight modifications, my theory would absolutely break down. Basically, if there's anything that starts complex that didn't build from simple, then I'm wrong. This theory is wrong. Now, here's what you have to realize. That could not evolve. You see, only life could evolve, and that's the simplest form of life. That's not something that Darwin's theory could have evolved. It all had to come together spontaneously. It had to create itself. Now, if you use Darwin's standards, what conclusions do we come to? You see, if you start with materialism and you start with the assumption that God is impossible and there is God can't exist, and so therefore we know that there is no God, so now the only answer is evolution. So of course it proves evolution because that's the only, you know, we only have one option, you know, multiple choice test. You only get A. But if you start with the assumption that there could be a God, I'm not even going to say that there is a God, but there could be a God, and it's possible that there might not be a God, and then you look at this and you say, and what it seems to be more consistent with the facts of science, that this spontaneously created itself, or that there was a creator that created it. Again, we know from experience and from scientific methods that, you know, that nothing like this comes together by itself. And the complexity, the design of the simplest form of life demands by Darwin's own standards that we reject his theory. But what happens is that people don't reject his theory because we start with the assumption, we know it's true, we know there is no God, and so therefore we have to continue to come up with new explanations, new guesses that somehow show that what we assume is right even though the evidence proves it's wrong. Well, it's not only that. You can look at another issue with Darwin, and that's the whole issue of the fossil record. He himself gave us this thing. In his book, he said that he acknowledged that the supporters of evolution have made all these predictions and that they have to come true to prove the truthfulness. And he said in that, okay, the one that's going to be, you know, have to come through most of all is the fossil record. He acknowledged in his book that the fact is that you would expect to find in this fossil record this gradual fossil record of showing how one animal became another, and that's what you would expect to find. And he said in his book, I don't have this on a slide, but let me read what he wrote. He said, what does the fossil record tell us? It tells us, that's not a quote from him. His quote is, why not is every geological formation and every stratum full of such intermediary links? Geology assuredly does not reveal such finely graded organic change. And this is perhaps the most obvious and serious objection that can be urged against my theory. Basically, I agree that the fossil record doesn't prove it. And so what does he say then? It was the answer. He basically said in the next line, he said, the explanation lies, I believe, in the extreme imperfection of the geographical record or geological record. Basically, we don't have enough fossils. And so when we find more fossils, it would prove me wrong. But if the fossils don't prove that there's these links, well, therefore my theory is wrong. That's Darwin. And so what do we find? Well, we have, in 150 plus years since then, we found all kinds of fossil records. We found all kinds of things. And what does it show? Let me not give my opinion. Let me give you the opinion of one of the ultimate scholars of this, a guy named Stephen Jay Gould. And he admitted the following. He's from Harvard, one of the greatest proponents of evolution. He said, the extreme rarity of the transitional forms in the fossil record persists. It's the trade secret of paleontology. The evolutionary trees that adorn the textbooks have data only at the tips and the nodes of the branches, basically saying science shows us there's adaptation, that you have things adapt, which we talked last week. There's microevolution. I agree with that. God created us so that we can adapt. He says, but the fossil record shows that there's nothing in between. There's no evidence of these links that are being filled in. He continues, the rest is inference, however reasonable, not the evidence of fossils. So basically, when you look at the textbooks and you see these all things, those aren't fossils. We've never found those fossils. They don't exist. We just keep guessing that they will. They've got to be there. And so we keep coming up with new explanations, new guesses. In fact, one guy, David Arup, who is the head of National Field Museum in Chicago, said Darwin was embarrassed by the fossil record because it didn't look the way he predicted it would. Now, we're 150 years after Darwin, and our knowledge of the fossil record has greatly expanded. We have 250,000 fossil species, but the situation hasn't changed much. He says, in fact, we have fewer examples of evolutionary transition than we did have in Darwin's time. They have fewer examples because the ones that you thought were examples of transition, they found out weren't. And so now if you look at Darwin, what does he say? This should prove it's true. And if you don't see the evidence, what happens? If you have a hypothesis and you look at the evidence and it always comes back negative, you leave the hypothesis. But the materialists, they don't do that. They come up with, well, you know, here's new explanations. And they have all these explanations. They're continuing to make up new theories to agree with their presumptions, even though the science proves their theories are wrong. My friends, we believe what we believe because it's true. And it's revealed to be true in science as well as in the Bible. Well, let's take another issue. Let's take the issue I mentioned with the cell. Well, how about I mentioned DNA? See, what you realize is that if you study this, evolutionary biologists had always thought that the real challenge of evolution was just how did biological life organize itself. What they found, though, and again with the microscopes and all this, is that in DNA, that the key to life is, or in the cell, DNA is the key to life. It's these proteins that organize themselves or organize almost like letters. In fact, they actually put them down as letters. And just as you have to organize letters to spell words, likewise, these proteins have to be organized in the exact right way to be able to spell life. In fact, it's microscopic. Bill Gates, in talking about this, talked about that the code of DNA is something far more complicated than any person has ever invented. So we've got this incredibly complicated code. You've got the proteins. We're not going to even go with that. But let me go to this whole idea. And if you say this is information, let's say if I were to take boxes of Scrabble letters. How long do I have to pour out Scrabble letters until you're going to get to be or not to be? That is the question. So let's see if I even, if I got hundreds of monkeys up here and had them all at typewriters and they're typing, how long before they type that sentence out? Now, here's what you've got to realize. That assumes typewriters and Scrabble letters. To use evolution, that assumes the proteins and the code of the DNA, which nobody can even explain where that came from. But even if you assume those two things that existed. Now, if you're pouring out Scrabble letters and getting monkeys and you're saying you're going to pour these out, how long before you get those two sentences? Do you know they're saying the simplest single-cell organism, bacteria, has not two lines of code, 800 pages of single-space code that had to be perfect for the single-cell bacteria to exist. The human being, our DNA, is more than like a 24-set encyclopedia. And that had to be perfect. And here we're saying, okay, what do we know? That we know from our experience that anytime there's information, it always comes from a mind. We know that scientifically. We know that from experience. You never have information that doesn't come from a mind. It never spontaneously happens. And here you have this incredibly precise, dense amount of information that has to be perfect, but the science of evolution is saying, oh, it all came from accident. It didn't come from a mind. Look at I have this quote up here. This is Francis Crick, one of the co-founders of DNA. And look what he says even about this. I didn't put this up here. It says, biologists must consistently keep in mind that what they see was not designed, but rather evolved. And here you have the co-founder saying, basically, everything is telling us that it was designed. It's obvious it's designed, but we have to continue to say, even though evidence tells us that it's designed, we know that it wasn't designed. It evolved by accident. My friends, again, what is more consistent? What does the facts of science point to? Third one, laws of science and the lack of positive mutations. I'll do this one quickly. You know, one of the basic laws of science, it's the second law of thermodynamics. It's a law, meaning it's always true. It's always acknowledged the truth. The second law of thermodynamics is this. You know, that all things tend toward entropy or randomness. Basically, the basic law is that it goes from order to disorder. And so that if, you know, we know this by experience, you know, if you put in something that's hot out, it's going to cool down. If you, you know, if you leave something alone for a long time, it doesn't evolve and get better, it breaks down. And so it's this idea that the universe becomes less ordered. Now that's a law, it always happens. Everything we see in the universe is, everything is running down, going from order to disorder. Now again, the two stories, the one is that in the beginning there was disorder and God spoke order into existence. And then sin came into the world, and ever since sin came into the world, it's causing the order to unwind and become less ordered. The other is that, no, evolution says, no, in the beginning there was nothing. There was absolutely nothingness, and the nothingness created everything, and the everything that it created out of total chaos suddenly organized itself into the incredibly precise order of the universe, let alone of life. I want to tell you, again, which one is more consistent? And you know what's interesting is when we talk about this, even when they say, well, here's evolution and we're going to expect these adaptations in evolution, they've done all kinds of studies on like single cell bacteria, and they've studied them over, you know, millions of literally generations and see how they, and you know what they find is they adapt, or fruit flies, which reproduce really quickly. There's adaptations, but at DNA level, any of the changes are never positive. DNA adaptations are always devolution, not evolution. It's always going backward. It's always applying in experience. Even at the cellular level, we're not evolving, we're devolving. The second law of thermodynamics is true. But you know what evolution says? Well, even though everything in science points that, you should believe this instead. My friends, we believe this because it's true. How about the evidence of obvious design? You know, this was something that, you know, people have talked about. You know, there's a famous book that was written in 1802, Paley's Watchmaker, and he talked about if you find a watch and you look at the design of the watch, you realize that there is a designer. There's nothing that exists that's intricately designed that isn't the result of a designer. Again, we know this in experience. So if you're walking somewhere and if you see this picture, and you don't look at that and you say, isn't that amazing that this couple got married and the wind just somehow blew those words there on the beach and it got that perfect picture. Isn't that something? Or, you know, you look at that and if you go to Disney World and you look at the, say, this is a magical place. Even the bushes grow like Mickey and Minnie, you know, and, you know, they even grow in colors. I mean, this is like, you talk about magical. That's, now I make fun of that, but what is it saying? Anytime you see design, you know there's always designer. We know that. And we know that by experience. Now, some people might say, well, but there's patterns that happen by accident of nature. And, yeah, you know, but let me give an example of that. In the Northeast, there's something, this is called a man in the mountain. It's a mountain case, you know, and they say, it kind of looks like a face of a man. And so this is kind of a famous thing. But when you look at that, you could see how that's, it kind of resembles, but it's not really a product of design. And sometimes you have things that kind of resemble, that you have a couple letters that come together, but not specifically. Now, there's a big difference between that and that. When you look at that, for anybody to say, well, that happened, isn't it amazing the way the wind blew? And, well, no, here we have specific people, and you see not, there's a big difference. And what do we know? Anytime that there is a design, there's always a designer. Now, I'm going to just give you an idea. This is where we're going to go next week. We're not only biologically designed, but if we are the product of design, then everything in our existence is the product of design. And so part of the evolution, or part of the idea of evolution, is that if everything is by chance, then nothing is designed. If we're product of creation, then everything is designed. And the implications of that are tremendous, and we're going to look at that next week. But here I just want to close with just this idea of we've got to realize that the Bible calls us to a biblical faith, not blind faith. And the more that we look at this, what I believe is that you see a blind faith of those who are teaching materialism and evolution. You know, we've looked at just briefly, and we're going to, you know, come Sunday night, we'll look at more things. I'm going to give you a bunch of resources next Sunday morning and with the notes. If you want to go as deep as you want, there are tons of things. But we've looked briefly at the complexity of the cell. We've seen how Darwin's theory itself breaks down. DNA and this, you know, where life comes from. We saw last week the organization of the universe and, you know, the incredible order. And we can look at so many of these things. So why is it that people still hold to evolution in spite of the fact that the evidence has seemed so strongly against them? I think for a lot of people, it's simply because that's what they're taught. You know, a lot of people, they don't know any better, and they're told, well, all scientists believe this, and this is what scientists, and we've never actually struggled with the truth. I think there are many that are deceived. But there are also many who I believe deep down kind of know the truth, but it's what we went to last week. It's not science. They're equating science with materialism. They're saying science denies the possibility of the supernatural. God cannot exist. And therefore, because we assume God cannot exist, therefore, we come to these conclusions in spite of the evidence. Last week, we shared this quote from Dr. Richard Lowenton, a geneticist, a Marxist, and a leader in evolutionary biology. He said this, "Our willingness to accept the scientific claims that are against common sense is the key to understanding the real struggle between science and the supernatural." In spite of, or we take the side of science, in spite of the patently absurd absurdity of some of its constructs, in spite of its failures to fulfill many of its extravagant promises of health and life, in spite of the tolerance of the scientific community for the unsubstantiated just-so stories, because we have a prior commitment, a prior to materialism. You see, it's not because of science, it's in spite of science. Because we have this prior commitment, we've made this assumption that the only things that can exist are science, and we'll call that science. He continues, "It is not that the methods of the institutions of science somehow compel us to accept a material explanation of the phenomenon world. It's not even that materialism comes from science." That's what he's saying. But on the contrary, we are forced by our prior adherence to material causes. These didn't come from science. They're non-scientific. It's an assumption that we make before we come to science. And we're forced by our prior adherence to these material causes to create an apparatus of investigation and a set of concepts that produce a material explanation, no matter how counterintuitive, no matter how mystifying to the uninitiated. Moreover, that materialism is absolute, for we cannot allow a divine foot in the door. My friends, God calls us to a faith that, as we saw in 1 Peter, is a faith that calls us to be ready to make a defense for anyone that asks for the reason of hope that is in us, a faith that is based on reason. And I hope that this morning and last week that I've started that. If you want to go deeper, I'll give you all the resources you want to go as deep as you want. But I also need to challenge you that ultimately either of these, there's a leap of faith that comes in that. There's a faith that's a leap that's not against logic, but that is consistent with logic, but yet it goes beyond what we can know. That even in, as we talked about in the confession, we don't proclaim I know, we proclaim I believe, because I believe makes a statement of something that not only do I know that is true, but I commit myself to that truth. And I believe in God the Father Almighty, creator of heaven and earth, and I not only know that that's the case, but I commit myself to a relationship with him. Because the story of the Bible is about this God creator who's pursued me and wants a relationship with me, even when I've sinned against him, that he pursued me and made a way for me to have a relationship with Jesus Christ. And my friends, I want to just close in that challenge, you know, so that, yes, this is, it's knowledge, and I hope that you're challenged and encouraged by it. But I also want to say, have you gone beyond what you know to what you believe? Do you have that relationship with Jesus Christ? Do you trust in him? Do you trust in this one who is your creator, your designer, and that you can rest in his control and his love, no matter what the circumstances you face? He invites us to know him, to rest in him in that way. And if you've never done that, I trust you, encourage you to do so today. If you're here and you're struggling with all this, again, go deeper. And for those of us who believe, I want you to realize that we have a hope. God calls us to have a defense and a knowledge, a reason behind what we believe. We believe what is true, not only because the Bible says it, but because everything says it, because it's ultimate reality. And that reality should speak to every area of life, both not only in what we know, but in the way we live. Thanks for joining us. If you have any questions about what we talked about, Jesus Christ, our church, or anything else, connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, or by email. We'd love to hear from you.